Remember, Paul is writing 2 Timothy as his final letter before he's executed by a Roman guardsman in about AD 67. And he's writing to his buddy, the guy that he had really taught and mentored, Timothy. And this is his second letter to Timothy. He opens up in this particular section in chapter 2, verse 3, where he says, "Suffer hardship with me." Of course, Paul is writing from prison. So this is quite a charge. Suffer hardship with me. Paul, you're in prison. Suffer hardship with me. This is a serious call for Paul to make. Some people think this is just suffering in general. You know, like if you pick up Christian books and you read Christian books, what do they always tell you? You know, it's like about suffering where you lose a family member or you lose a spouse or a job or an opportunity or something like that. That's not this. That's not the context for this form of suffering. And indeed, if you were to write a Christian book on this form of suffering, it wouldn't sell because Christians in the Western world don't believe in this form of suffering. And you might be like, what kind of suffering? The kind of suffering that refers to loving and giving yourself in love sacrificially to other people. Ministry is what some people call it. Remember in verses 1 and 2, it was teaching, discipleship, which is teaching an individual believer, and leadership, servant leadership. And, of course, this is written to another Christian leader. This isn't just the problem of suffering in general, in other words. This is written from one committed Christian to another about the suffering that comes from giving your life away to other people in love. How could that be suffering? It is suffering. Therefore, what we're reading here is that this is the kind of suffering that refers to a follower of Jesus making the voluntary choice to suffer for the cause of Christ. Now, I hesitate to teach this passage tonight because I'm well aware that there could be some people sitting here tonight that are still trying to figure out what they believe with regard to spiritual things. And you're still on your spiritual exploration and still trying to figure that out. And I'm talking about suffering by giving your life away to others in sacrificial love. And that might just be like, ooh, that's kind of gross. You know, why would I want to get involved in something like this? For you, if you're here tonight and you're in that situation, what I want you to hear is this. You need to take in the love of God first. What we're talking about here is if you've already become a Christian, this is a voluntary choice to choose to give your life away to others. So if you haven't made that decision, this is not the voluntary choice you should make. The choice that you should make is not to give out love to God, but to receive the love that he has through Jesus Christ. Well, is this suffering and hardship really worth it? Paul's going to give us a number of different metaphors here to describe the type of suffering to which he's referring, a soldier, an athlete, and a farmer. And you start to look at these metaphors and you start to wonder, is it really worth it to give your life away like that on that level? Let's see. He says here in verse 3, "Do this as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No soldier in active service entangles himself in the affairs of everyday life so that he may please the one who enlisted him as a soldier. Also, if anyone competes as an athlete, he does not win the prize unless he competes according to the rules. So too, the hardworking farmer ought to be the first to receive his share of the crop." So he says, suffer with me. And then he says, like a soldier, like an athlete, like a farmer. And then he says this in verse 7, consider what I just said. It's as if Paul is saying, okay, I just laid out these three pictures. Do you realize the enormity of the call I'm making? To suffer like a soldier, to suffer like an athlete, to suffer like a farmer. Sit there and ponder it, to think about it. Why would he compare Christian love and service to those three different metaphors? He says, if you do this, the Lord will give you understanding in everything. And that's principally what we're going to do here tonight. We're going to consider what are the analogs or the parallels or the similarities between these three metaphors that Paul gives and what it looks like to follow Jesus Christ. Let's begin with that first one. How is the Christian life similar to a soldier? Well, surely this subject of being a soldier or military warfare is something that is often repeated in the New Testament. We see this, for example, when Paul writes to fellow Christian workers, he calls them his fellow soldiers. He refers to putting on the armor, the breastplates, the shields, the helmets, the weapons. Not literally, right? It's not that we literally are putting on some kind of, AK-47 or something like that. These are spiritual weapons, he says, to demolish fortresses, 2 Corinthians chapter 10. So too, our enemy is not like in the Christian fundamentalist world, where the enemy is the culture wars. Our enemy is not people. People are the mission. They're not the enemy. The enemy, according to the New Testament, is Satan, Ephesians 6:12. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood. It's not against the people, but against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. So here we see that each individual person on planet Earth, every man, woman, boy, and girl on planet Earth, they're the mission. We're not here fighting against anyone else. This is where the analogy kind of breaks down for us, because when you think of modern day warfare, you think I'm defending my nation, you know, my family and so forth, and I'll kill, you know, the Russians or the Canadians or whoever, you know, I'm here to protect mine. Well, that's not the picture here. The picture, according to Philippians 3:20, is that we're citizens of heaven. And because we're citizens of heaven, we're here to reach people with the love and forgiveness of Jesus Christ. Well, why does he make this comparison here? For one, soldiers, they are on a mission that is life and death. I think that is fair to say. Getting into war, not being in the reserves. I'm saying going into active war, that is a matter of life and death. If you lose, that could have incredible consequences, not just for yourself, but for those you love. And evil forces could cascade right across your country, your nation, people whom you love. And this is life and death. And so a soldier going into war, that would be pretty serious. I can't think of anything more serious. I mean, turn on the news. Look at the Ukraine right now. Killing women, children, orphanages, schools. It seems to me that Paul is trading on this concept and leveraging it to show what? That as Christians, we are in a battle of life and death. Only the enormity is incommensurably bigger. To think, you know, the people who die right now in war, they will have been dead in 100 years no matter what. But the battle that we're fighting here for people's souls, people are eternal. We're not just physical meat sacks, you know, with juices and chemicals, molecules, emotion. That's not the extent of human beings. We are also spiritual, which means that we continue to live forever, either with God or apart from God. Forever. Dear God, imagine how incredible of an ecstasy that would be to wake up and you're in front of God in heaven. Forever. That is a matter of life and death. So too, imagine the horror of waking up in hell and realizing you just rejected the love of God forever. Oh, that would be a tragedy beyond all human imagination or conception. And so to realize that we could extend our lives forever and that as Christians, we could play a role in seeing people come to know the love of Christ. Oh, this is incredibly way bigger. Like imagine if I had a pill that I could give to you. And I'm like, this pill would give you, you know, a hot body, six pack abs, dimples, you know, cleft chin. I don't know. I don't know what's hot. Anyways, I get this pill. And you wouldn't have any aches or pains, nothing like that. I give you the pill, and you could have a body like that any point in your life for 25 years. So you could be in your 60s, take the pill, all of a sudden, you know, you are like Zac Efron. I don't know. You're looking good. You know what I'm saying? I think people would be interested in that pill, wouldn't they? Like if you could extend your life 25 years, and it'd be a good life, I think people would be interested in that. We're not talking about something so superficial as that. We're talking about something that is actually eternal. Soldiers, too, need training. I would hate to go out there as a soldier not being physically in shape, not being mentally, knowing what I'm doing, not having a plan, no strategy, tactics. What does it mean to flank? How do you use this gun? How do you reload it? So, too, as Christians, you know, the youngest Christian, if you're here and you're a new Christian, you can build people up very quickly. I'm amazed at how quickly young Christians can build people up with just a simple word, simple insight. And yet, at the same time, very quickly you understand you need some training, don't you? You start to look around and you're like, I wish I had the right thing to say. I wish I had the right skills. I mean, not just intellectual. I don't mean just academic, like knowing the Bible. Like we're all growing in that. I mean, too, like relational. I wish I could, you know how to listen. You know, most people in this room, you think you're a good listener. You're not a good listener. This is an incredible skill. to have a person be able to connect with you and know you and feel listened to, feel heard, feel understood. We need training. We need equipping. Yeah. Soldiers need courage and encouragement from others. Oh, is that true? I can't imagine the terror of going to war. You know, just some of the reports I've read in history, movies that I've seen and stuff, the terror of the night before going out into battle. They used to call it shell shock. And then it became battle fatigue. And now it's post-traumatic stress disorder. But whatever you call it, it's serious. And these guys coming back, you know, from war, they are in bad shape because you need courage. No doubt about it. And so, too, you need leaders and people around you that are able to put courage in, to encourage you. So there could be times, analogously, in the Christian life, where you are lacking the courage and yet a brother or sister in Christ could come alongside you and literally give you the courage that you need. Makes me think of this scene. This is from the epic HBO miniseries, Band of Brothers. There's one character here, Winters. God, do I love this guy. I wake up every morning and wish I was Winters, all right? And then Blythe, he's kind of sniveling. He's going through shock. He's freaking out in the little ditch there. Look at the way Winters encourages Blythe. Check this out. Great scene. Great show. Oh, if you haven't seen that show, you're doing yourself a disservice as a Christian worker. You should see that show. So good, man. That scene, I love that. He's in the trench or whatever, and he's losing it. He's panicking. He's freaking out. I mean, it's one thing to train, and then you're in the war, and then all of a sudden, he's completely fried. In Winters, not only is screaming words of encouragement to him, but he gets up on top of the dirt. And you see that scene where Blythe is looking up at Winters like, holy hell, like he's actually standing up. I can at least pick my head up out of the foxhole. You know what I'm saying? And I love how Winters, it's not a soothing encouragement. You know what I mean? Like we use that word encouragement and we usually think of soothing encouragement. There's a place for that. That's not this. This is when people are feeling like they can't move forward, speaking words of courage. You can do this. And it actually, if we agree with people that they can't do it, that actually has the inverse effect. That only encourages their fears, that makes them feel like they're weak, like they can't do anything. And instead we need to say, you can do it. Go out there. Even if you need to fail, go out there and fail. And this can be very powerful. Very powerful. Soldiers know that now is not the time to take it easy. Imagine being in battle at a war, and you got a soldier out there for 2 weeks or 3 weeks learning some kind of a hobby. He's out there learning how to play chess or playing the guitar. Or something like that. You'd be like, there's something fundamentally wrong here when you got people on the front lines fighting and you're back here screwing around, right? I mean, just what an absurd picture that is. That's a couple weeks. What if he was doing this for months or years on end? We're in the middle of life or death. Now is not the time to be distracted. As Paul puts it, no soldier in active service entangles himself in the affairs of everyday life. So I know I could nuance this to death. I know I could say, you know, there's a room for hobbies and room for vacation and there's room for, you know, rest. And I'm going to get to that. But what I'm saying here is we're in a war. And it makes sense that when you're in a war and time is short and it's life or death, now is the time to fight because the time is going to be over very soon. Is this worth it? Yeah, these soldiers going to war. Coming back, I don't think they would say any of the sacrifice they put in was not worth it. Of course it was worth it to stand there for generations to come, realizing the course of human history could have changed, realizing your entire nation could have been taken over, that you liberated the captives, prisoners. Hell yes, that was worth it. God, would that be worth? Nobody would look back and say, oh, you know, I really wish I had stuck back a little bit more. The position that we're in is way different. We can't lose. There's no such thing as going out into the foray and getting a bullet to the brain and then you're out of commission. If that's what happens to us, the worst thing that happens is a second later we wake up and we're in heaven. Okay? We can't lose. The worst thing that can happen is we die and then we're in heaven. So that's losing. That's losing the battle. That's not losing. That's winning. And to be able to push forward, yeah, that would be worth it. All right. What about this one here though? The athlete. Many images of this in the New Testament as well. Running a race, boxing, we see too, competing for an athletic prize. Paul and James and Peter, they're always using that word, Stephanos, the wreath you put on the person's head. And they say, that's kind of like what we're going to get in heaven. Self-control and discipline. Paul says, I buffet my body, make it my slave to be able to be a better servant, a better athlete. And he says, we got to compete according to the rules. Let's unpack this a little bit. Athletes need mental discipline in order to win. I've heard from people who are runners. I myself am not a runner. The longest I've ever run is 3 miles. I was running from the cops at the time. I'm just screwing around. No, I was on a treadmill and I was like, I made it 3 miles. And I remember thinking at the time, that's the longest I've ever run. And that is the longest I've ever run to this day. But I've heard from runners, they're all like, man, it's all in your mind. You can keep going. You can keep going. It's a mental discipline to keep pushing. It's true for athletes as well. You know, I remember hearing a story about Kobe Bryant going up against Michael Jordan. And Kobe had a particularly bad game against Michael. At the end, Michael, you know, hit him up and leaned into his ear and whispered. He said, you know, I notice you're wearing my Air Jordans. He said, well, you can wear the shoes, but you can't fill the shoes. Kobe Bryant walked out of the arena. He didn't talk to anyone for 3 days. He showed up to practice so much in advance. He shot 500 shots before the rest of the team got there. Then they would practice, and then he wouldn't talk to anyone. He'd hit the weight room. Then he'd go back and shoot another 500 shots after practice was done. He did this whole thing. He came back and played against Jordan 3 days later. He had 45 points on Jordan. Mental discipline. Mental discipline. Anyone else there? Think about that. That would get in your head, wouldn't it? Having somebody there, you know, trying to fake you out, psych you out. You're just not good enough. Everyone thinks you're such a big deal. You're not a big deal. That's kind of analogous to Satan. See, Satan would want to get into your head and tell you that you're a loser, an idiot, a fool, you're inadequate. You're not good enough. You don't fit in around here. And you need the mental discipline to arrest those thoughts, to take them captive and to say, no, that's just not true. And to not let that control your behavior. Mental discipline. So too, athletes work hard and they rest hard. I remember reading a book on weightlifting and the guy made the point in there. He said, you know, there's a lifting, there's a rest, and then there's diet. And he says, some people think it's, you know, this much percentage lifting, this much diet, this much rest. He said, actually, it's 100% lifting, 100% diet, and 100% rest. And I thought, that is really bad math. But I know exactly what he's talking about there, right? That makes a lot of sense. By the way, that's as far into weightlifting as I got. I read the book and I thought that counted. Like that would make me stronger somehow. Anyways, the point is working hard as an athlete, you need to put in the work. You also need to feed yourself and you need to be able to rest. If you just work hard, like, you know, frenzy until you're completely fried, that is a recipe for disaster. You're going down if that's the case. So too, if all you're doing is resting, you're not going to be a good athlete either. And some of us need to hear that first part. You need to work hard. A lot of our problems are we feel so overwhelmed all the time. Everything that we do is just so onerous and just so hard. It's such a heavy labor that we're carrying. Meanwhile, you look across the room, you see somebody else doing 5-10 times the work that person is, happy, excited, giving their life away to other people. Hard work feels good. Feels good to work hard for the Lord, to lay your head down on the pillow at the end of the night and to say, that felt good to work hard. Some of us need to hear the second part, to rest hard. There are times where you need to take it easy. Having, you know, portions of your schedule deliberately laid out where I'm just going to get some rest. I'm going to pick up a hobby. I'm going to get some sleep. I need sleep. We can't just keep working and working and working like my buddy told me, like you're the Messiah of Columbus, Ohio, with these delusions of grandeur. Okay, God doesn't need you, all right? He's choosing to use you. And he's going to use you, and he wants you to work hard. Yeah, yeah, yeah. However, there is such a thing as overheating, overdoing it to the point where you're falling apart. That is what we would refer to as fanaticism, where you're working so hard that you're actually hurting yourself. Listen, you're not helping anybody. You need to learn how to pull it right back. Athletes have coaches and trainers who help facilitate growth. Yeah, you could do it on your own, I suppose. Like you could be an Olympic athlete and just go your own way, do the reading, do the study. Wouldn't it help, though? Remember we were talking about discipleship last week. Wouldn't it help to get somebody there to help you who knows what they're doing, knows what they're talking about? You know, if you don't know the difference between a protein, a carb, and a fat, and to have somebody there like making the meals for you and explaining everything and how to stretch and all that, wouldn't that be great? Now, these people at the end of the day, you get to take their advice or not. They're the coach. They're the trainer, right? And at the end of the day, you're the one with the Olympic medal, and it's on you whether you're going to win or you're going to lose, right? You can't say, well, that coach back there really screwed things up. No, you're the person who's going forward, and you're the person who's going to answer to the, well, you can see where this is bleeding over, right? At the end of the day, people are there to help us in Christian community, but at the end of the day, we need to take ownership for our own lives. There's coaching, there's training, but I will stand before God. You will stand before God with people helping us, yes, but not taking the credit, no. Athletes lose everything for cheating. Paul writes in verse 5, he does not win the prize unless he competes according to the rules. I've seen so many games where, you know, it's coming down to the fourth quarter, typically Cleveland Browns games. And, you know, it's right down there at the very end and you're on the 20 and, you know, Hail Mary pass, catches it. Oh, praise God, he caught it. And then, you know, to the 40, to the 30, to the 20, to the 10, touchdown, Cleveland Browns. You know, we're coming out of our seats just going ballistic. And then, you know, what always happens next? There's a flag on the field, and, you know, it's like some idiot held somebody way away from the action, and they're pulling it all the way back to the 20, and the game is over. Cleveland Browns lose. Oh, that's so terrible. What, it just makes you want to puke in your mouth. Athletes, if you're going to cheat, all that big touchdown you did, what's it mean? Nothing. It means nothing. You think of Lance Armstrong, 7 consecutive titles. Jackets, the Tour de France, or the Tour de France, if you prefer. He won the Tour de France 7 consecutive times, and yet there were rumors floating out there that he was cheating, he was doping, he was using drugs to enhance his performance. He was the pride and joy of everybody, especially the thing, too, was it was the French accusing him, and everyone in America was like, of course, the French, man, it's the Tour de France. And the French would want to do that. It turns out it was all true. They stripped every last bit of his jackets. He's no longer to be in any professional sports. And yet, he had the audacity in 2001 to make this Nike commercial. Check this out. You ready? You ready? Okay, your silence means you're ready. Here it is.
Everybody wants to know what I'm on. What am I on? I'm on my bike, busting my ass 6 hours a day. What are you on?
Oh. Liar. What a liar. Correct answer. Steroids. That's what you're on. Roids is what you're on. Athletes, they got to sacrifice now for what they hope to achieve later. Yeah, you talk to serious athletes, competitive athletes, and it's work. God, is that hard work, getting up early every day, you know, limiting yourself, freely giving up your rights for what you could have for later, for later, for later. I remember seeing 2016 LeBron James winning the finals, game 7, 3-1 comeback, brings in the finals, the block, the game's over. And he was so composed. He was so stoic until finally the, you know, buzzer went off and he was laying on the ground like a little child weeping. I have no idea what that's like. I have no idea. To put in that much work for those many years and then to be there in front of such amazing glory and having won the glory that he experienced, nothing compared to what we're experiencing when we get to heaven. We're going to be standing before the only two eyes in the universe that matter, the only being whose approval matters, and he's going to be looking at every single one of us saying, well done, You did such a great job. I'm so proud of you. You worked so hard. I watched every second of it. Just come in. We got so much joy. Just enjoy it. Just enjoy what this is like. This is going to be, and we're going to be here forever. Is that worth it? Yeah, those hours are worth it. I don't know if you're limping in here tonight, you know, working hard for the Lord and you needed a little bit of a refresh here. Is this worth it? I'm working really hard. Yes, it's worth it. It is worth it. Endure, suffer hardship with Christ. Keep going. Good God, is it worth it? Every single ounce of effort we put forward into this, God is watching. He sees all of it. And it will be all worth it in the end. Finally, number three, the farmer. Tons of these metaphors in the New Testament, planting and watering crops. Soils is the way that Jesus describes the spread of his message of love and forgiveness. He says the harvest is plentiful, the workers are few. Why? Why this metaphor? Like of all metaphors you could pick, why does he say farming? Seems to me, for one, farmers have a humble yet vital profession. They don't get the LeBron James glory. They don't get the Captain Winters glory. You know, they don't get the medals, the Medal of Valor. They don't get any of that. But what do they get? The knowledge that what they're doing is keeping humanity alive. That's what they're doing. Like if all the farmers just quit, we would die. That's what would happen. And very few professions are that way. Other people would quit. You know, it would be an inconvenience. Farmers quit, we would be gone. The human race would just walk off into extinction and that would be it. So it's a humble profession. No one's winning Farmer of the Year. No one's a farmer on a big magazine. You know what I mean? But God, are they important? So I guess what I'm saying here is that the analog here between this and Christianity is that we're taking a humble role. Not being a big shot, not getting, you know, some kind of a big name for myself or anything, but knowing that what I'm doing really matters. Farmers work long and hard hours, that's for sure. Farming. I know many of us we grew up in the city, but you get around some guys who are farmers. I couldn't think of the term. My vocabulary well is dry tonight. Anyways, you get around some hardworking farmers and you start asking them questions like, so what do you do in a single day? And it's amazing. The hours they get up, they go to bed. My dad knew a guy who used to be a farmer. He became a tradesman. He could pick up a sledgehammer by the end of the sledgehammer and lift it straight out like that. All the other guys would break their wrist. How did he get to do that? Not from being in the gym, from farmer strength. The labor of just doing incredibly hard, back-breaking work for years on end. You can do these freak things. These are these incredible people. God, that's hard work. Farmers need to be consistent. You know, you might have a sick day or something, sure. But just to say, I'm just going to not show up for a week, not show up for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Well, you have the freedom to do that, yes. But your crops have the freedom to die. And there's no going back. I mean, you could have some droughts or whatever and no irrigation where it's over. So farming, a lot of it is just showing up, being consistent, even when you don't feel like you're doing much. Farmers know that they can only grow so much of the crop. I mean, they've got a role. They've got to plant and they've got to irrigate and so forth. But at the end of the day, I mean, nature does its thing. And to an ancient person, to look at the ground and there's nothing there. It's just there's dirt. And I know I put seeds in there and I know I put water on there, but I just got to trust and wait that seed is going to grow. And I know not all the seeds are going to grow. Some of them aren't going to take hold and some of them are going to die out. But I know my role was just to spread that seed and to irrigate it and nurture it and hope that it's going to do its thing. And the similarity with Christianity is what? It's that we shouldn't ever take over the role of God. I remember talking to one guy. He said, you know, so you think you can convince me to become a Christian, huh? And I was like, no, I can't do that. The Spirit of God has to work in your heart. You need to have an interaction with Him. I'm not a superhuman. God Himself needs to do that work. I'm just the messenger. I'm just here to help. And if I can help answer some questions and share some things with you, bring a friendship, you know, I'll do my part. But at the end of the day, that's between you and God. And many of us are trying to take the role of the planter, the irrigator, and also the grower. And God says, that is not your job. That is my job. So we need to stay within our limits, knowing that the blood, sweat, and tears, all worth it. Are you seeing a repeated theme here? There's fighting now. There's working hard now. There's training now. There's restricting myself now. There's getting up early now. There's being in the sun all day now for later. Later, when I'm able to cash in on the crop. Later, when I can get the medal. Later, when we win the war. We're not seeing this now. I gotta wait. And I gotta be still and know this is coming. It's on its way. Well, to wrap up, Paul certainly thought this was worth it. I mean, he's sitting in a jail, writing his final letter to Timothy, and he's talking about the soldier and the farmer and the athlete. And later in verse 4, we read Paul was the farmer who used to get up there in season when things were going well or out of season. Paul was the persistent athlete who finished his course. And Paul was the good soldier who fought the good fight. You know, Paul, at this period of his life, was about to die. And he's like, Timothy, I lived my life to the end this way, and it was all worth it. In prison? About to have your head decapitated? That was all worth it? Paul says, yeah, I wouldn't take anything back. Let's push that a step further. How do you think Paul feels today? 19 centuries later, he's been in heaven. Do you think he looks back and he thinks, I really wish I hadn't worked so hard in season and out of season. I really wish I hadn't finished my course or fought the good fight. Now, I bet Paul is thinking to himself, if only I could have given a little bit more, I would have. Which brings us to our question for you here tonight, which is this. Do you believe it's worth it? See, Paul made his case. Paul said, like a soldier, you know, having to wait for the war to be over. It's worth it for him. And the athlete, it's worth it for him or her. And the farmer, it's worth it for him. But is it worth it for you? That's the question before you here tonight. And I would just suggest to you to be honest with God wherever you're at right now. Get honest with him and express your heart to him and say, I don't know if I believe this. And I'm not looking at other people, you know, what they think. I want to know, like, sometimes, like, when I get up here and teach, I kind of feel like the middleman. Like, sometimes you could hear it from me, and you don't actually get before God and talk to him. Like, you could sit through this entire teaching on whether it's worth it to live for Christ and just walk away and say, oh, that was nice. But never sit before God and hear from him. Is this worth it? Figure that out with him here tonight. Pray to him and ask him, is this worth it?